This is Karin Zissis of ASCOA Online. October is bringing big changes when it comes to matters high on Mexico's agenda. Security and energy, two issues that perhaps more than any others can decide the country's future course. First off, we hear about how an October 8th security summit of top-level U.S. and Mexican cabinet members saw the end of the 13-year-old bilateral pact known as the Merida Initiative and the birth of the Bicentennial Framework. Cecilia Farfán Méndez, head of security research programs at the Center for U.S.-Mexican Studies at UC San Diego, told me that for many experts, the new accord feels more like a rebranding than a true change. Still, after a bumpy year for bilateral security cooperation, the good news is now the two sides are finally playing ball.
I would say that we're on first base now. There's still a long way to go. There's a lot of help that needs to happen from, you know, other teammates and in other areas to get things going. But I think after having been going through innings with no real play, now we're at least on base.
If security is a matter where agreements are getting forged, energy is an area of discord. On October 1st, Mexico's President Andrés Manuel López Obrador introduced a constitutional reform that would give the state electricity company over half the power market and eliminate the country's Autonomous Energy Regulatory Agency, better known as the CRE. Analysts and members of the business sector say the reform would spell trouble for future private investment. That is, if it passes, the president, often referred to as AMLO, doesn't have the seats in Congress, though he's using the matter as a wedge issue to divide the opposition. In the second half of this episode, we hear from Montserrat Ramiro, an energy expert and former commissioner of the CRE, about what the reform means for Mexico's investment climate, environmental commitments, and the future of its energy sector.
You're listening to Latin America in Focus.
Latinoamérica en Foco.
América Latina en Foco.
A podcast by America Society, Council of the Americas, on politics, economics, and culture in the region.
Thank you so much for being with me today, Cecilia, and I'm going to get right into it. So, on October 8th, we saw a top-level visit from U.S. officials to Mexico City. Secretary of State Antony Blinken, Secretary of Homeland Security Alejandro Mayorkas, meeting with Foreign Minister Marcelo Ebrard. And it's fair to say that the biggest takeaway is that the $3 billion, 13-year-old Merida initiative is getting retired. It's been replaced by, and now this is a mouthful, by what's known as the U.S.-Mexico Bicentennial Framework for Security, Public Health, and Safe Communities. We'll just call it the Bicentennial Framework for short. Tell us what this change from one pact to another entails.
Well, thank you for having me. It's really great to have this conversation with you. I think for a lot of us who study U.S.-Mexico security cooperation, it feels more like a rebranding than a true change in what the pact is. And so while it's really good to see that they're reactivating a conversation that had been strained at times and sort of like languishing sort of like on the sideline compared to how trade talks had been going, it really is not that distinct when we look at the priorities of this bicentennial framework from what Merida prioritized, especially after it was revamped during the Obama administration.
Great. And just to give some background on some of the things you mentioned, we know that in September, the two countries came together for the high-level economic dialogue and now for this high-level security dialogue. In some ways, with security, it felt like there was more to repair because for the past year, things have been tense as a result of the arrest and later the return of Salvador Cienfuegos. the former defense minister to Mexico. He was arrested in the United States and then returned to Mexico, causing friction and some issues in security. And one thing that we're seeing discussed a lot is that the Merida Initiative really initially focused on targeting drug cartels, on taking out capos, on providing equipment. And then as you mentioned, it shifted during the Obama administration. Can you talk about what shifted? How did it change in recent years? And to what degree will those changes get carried through into the bicentennial framework?
So what's interesting about the Merida Initiative is that it evolved over the years. And so what it really reflected was, while U.S.-Mexico security cooperation for many decades was really focused on the narcotic side and specifically on the supply side, as Merida expanded, it really started taking into account other areas that are essential for thinking about safe communities, which, again, is language that is used again in this bicentennial framework. So it also emphasized a lot in developing the rule of law and also just investing in communities, also to develop, in Merida language, resilient communities, but in this bicentennial framework language, strong and safe communities.
There are two priorities that were highlighted. Well, there were many priorities that were highlighted on both sides, but I wanted to touch on two of them. On the Mexican side, there was this emphasis on stemming the flow of guns from the United States into Mexico. Now, that's not necessarily a new issue. Mexican presidencies prior to this one, they've long railed against it, though the current one perhaps upped the ante by suing U.S. gun manufacturers. Are there any concrete steps that came out of this meeting on the matter in order to stem the smuggling of U.S. guns into Mexico?
I think it's interesting because, at least from the fact sheets that were published both by Mexico and the U.S. government, separate from the joint statement that they also had, what's interesting is that there's an emphasis on bilateral efforts on stemming gun trafficking. So what's interesting here is that the language is saying, yes, the U.S. is responsible, but so is Mexico. So what's, you know, this sort of, I think, also shifts that focus that we had in the last, you know, few weeks since the Mexican government sued these gun manufacturers, because he's saying, well, this has to be a bilateral effort. And my guess is that the U.S. probably pushed for that language to be included, that this is not something that the U.S. has to do on its own, but also something that Mexico has to do. I think the challenge is that it doesn't, at least publicly, there's no details as to how they plan to do this. I mean, there's some very sort of vague allusions to sharing information, which, again, that language is not new. This is something that we have seen before when Mexico and the U.S. get together to talk about security. So specifically, how is it that they're going to achieve this? It's something that remains to be done. But what I think it's interesting from, you know, this bicentennial framework language, again, is that it emphasizes a bilateral effort that has to go into it.
So what do you think could be done? You know, there have been studies that showed that 70% of the weapons seized in Mexico, illicit weapons seized in Mexico, could be traced back to the United States. And there's been blame laid on just how lax gun laws are, particularly in the southwest of the United States. What would be a concrete step that could actually make an impact into stopping those guns from flowing into Mexico?
I think it's very important that you bring this up, because I think one of the key components of this strategy is that the Mexican government is certainly not trying to change U.S. domestic law. I mean, it's obviously not the remit of the Mexican government, and they would be way out of line, right, trying to say we need to make changes to the Second Amendment. I think what the Mexican government can do is, within the context of existing regulations, there is definitely improvements that could be had. And so I think in that sense, for example, collecting better information and sharing it with its Mexican counterparts on purchases along the border, which is where the majority of guns that go into Mexico illegally happen. I think, interestingly, there's a lot of emphasis on gun trafficking, but some other civil society organizations have also pointed out that we need to also pay attention to guns that are illegally imported into Mexico, but then who is the ultimate user of these guns? So, for example, if the Mexican army is purchasing guns from the U.S., is it the army that is the one using them, or are they selling them to municipal police forces that perhaps are suspected of being colluded with criminal groups? And so I think there's also those areas within even legal transactions where there's more that could be done by both governments.
Mm-hmm. Now, if we're going to turn to the U.S. side, a big concern for the U.S. side was fentanyl. And now this is a newer problem. Why is fentanyl such a concern in this bilateral security relationship? And what are some of the steps that we saw come out of that came out of Friday's discussion that could help to stem the problem of fentanyl?
So drug use is an area that has generally been discussed precisely in the context of security. What fentanyl change is really the lethality that it can have with very small doses. And so in some cases, drug users don't necessarily know that they are consuming fentanyl. And so it has become very lethal and is the main driver of the overdose deaths that we're seeing in the U.S., which, by the way, CDC just released preliminary data, and it looks like it's going to be 90,000 deaths in 2020, which is a significant increase from 2019. And so what the U.S. government wants, in line with what it has requested in previous years, is just to stem the drug flow from the south to the north, but in particular with fentanyl, just with how lethal it is, there's an urgency to really pay attention to these illicit drug flows. I think, interestingly, and tying it to the conversation on firearms, there's a lot that could be done here between both countries, because in my view, these are twin tragedies. You have a lot of loss of life in the U.S. because of overdose deaths, and you have a lot of loss of life in Mexico because of these firearms. And I think to the extent that we can, both governments could show that you care about loss of life in the other side of the border, that could really go a long way in getting working agreements between both countries. Mm-hmm. With fentanyl, I think similar to firearms, there were not specific details as to what to do. I think an important change that they made explicit is that they don't want to criminalize users, that they realize that punitive measures against drug users is not going to solve the problem. So I think that's an important change, again, in the narrative around drug consumption. But the details of how it can be implemented are still very blurry.
It's often been thought that Mexico just supplies the drugs to the United States and consumption in Mexico remains low. But I have read that that's been changing a little bit with fentanyl. So is that part of why you mentioned this? I mean, is there an issue around acknowledging that issue in Mexico, acknowledging that there is a drug abuse issue with fentanyl in Mexico?
We think so. And especially, you know, being at the border between the U.S. and Mexico, this is far more visible for us there. This is not something that you observe in Mexico City with the same severity, but being border towns where you have this convergence of trafficking and drug users and, you know, sort of like all the warehousing that happens also for, you know, drug trafficking groups, you see a lot more use in those areas. And so NGOs that provide services for drug users, both Mexican and American in this sort of border area, you see that problem a lot more than you see it from Mexico City. So I think this is why it has been a lot harder for the federal government to really tap into, you know, the Mexican federal government to really realize like, oh, well, we have an issue here and we should pay attention to it.
Now, one thing that's interesting with both of these issues is that to stop guns from heading south and to stop the flow of drugs north, it involves cooperation around intelligence. Do you see after the past year where there was some bumps in the road on that regard, do you see the chance that they're going to be coming closer together on this now?
I think the jury's still out on that one. And I think because when we think about U.S. and Mexico security cooperation, we also have to keep in mind the number of agencies from both countries that interact, right? And so at any given time, you have agencies that may have competing or even conflicting interests operating in the other country. And so when we think about intelligence, I think there's some very particular agencies within the U.S. government that are still very upset about how Cienfuegos was sent back to Mexico. And not only that, he was sent back to Mexico, but he was acquitted by the Mexican justice system. And so I think there's still some sore points there. Now, I do think that the signal from the foreign ministry is coming to sort of have a reset in the conversation. And so I can see, you know, areas or agencies who want to work together, that this will facilitate working together. Those who also don't want to really exchange intel or really work, I can see them also using this bureaucracy to stall that work. But I think for those who are interested in having that kind of engagement, this bicentennial framework, I think, opens a path to do it in a better way than what we were having basically by the end of last year, where, you know, Cienfuegos arrest happened and there were these discussions about modifying Mexico's legislation that regulates how foreign agents operate in the country.
So, you know, talking about this bilateral relationship, before they met on Friday in Mexico City, you wrote a column for Mexico Today, and I'm going to paraphrase what you wrote. You said, if the U.S.-Mexico relationship were a baseball game, the high-level economic dialogue would be on second base, while the conversation on security would be anxiously waiting on deck. Would you update the state of play after Friday? What would you say the state of play is now and why?
Yes, I would. I would say that we're on first base now. There's still a long way to go. There's a lot of help that needs to happen from, you know, other teammates and in other areas to get things going. But I think after having been going through innings with no real play, now we're at least on base and we can see, you know, there's potential for different outcomes. But of course, a long way to go before scoring a run.
Right. And the actual framework is going to be, got 3 months to put it together and release it in January. Is that right?
Yes.
Great. Well, thank you very much for talking with me today, Cecilia. It was a pleasure to get caught up on how security cooperation is going between these two countries.
Yeah, thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
That was Cecilia Farfán Méndez, a security expert at UC San Diego. Next up, at the beginning of October, Mexico's president, López Obrador, or AMLO, pitched a constitutional reform that would give the state electricity firm, known as the CFE, at least a 54% stake in the power market, and it would cancel permits awarded to private companies for electricity generation as part of the country's landmark 2013 energy reform. It would also see autonomous energy regulatory agencies lose their independence by getting absorbed into government ministries, as well as give the government control over lithium extraction. The reform faces roadblocks ranging from the USMCA trade deal to environmental agreements, given that many of the CFE's existing plants operate with dirty fuels. Then there's the fact that AMLO's coalition doesn't have the legislative seats it needs to usher through a constitutional change. I spoke with Montserrat Ramiro, a former commissioner with Mexico's Energy Regulatory Agency, about the prospects for the reform's passage and what the proposal means for Mexico's energy and investment outlook. Thank you very much for being with me today. Now, it's no secret that AMLO has sought a statist approach to Mexico's energy sector, and he's been taking steps to slow the course of a 2013 constitutional reform that opened up the oil and electricity sectors to private and foreign investment. Now, in recent weeks, López Obrador submitted an electricity reform to Congress that seeks to give greater control to the Federal Electricity Commission, also known as the CFE. So I wanted to start off and ask you to tell us, what are some of the key changes being introduced in this reform?
Well, one of the most important things that I would say about this initiative is that it is very clear on what it wants to strike down, but it's not particularly clear on what it wants to build and what it wants to accomplish as a whole for the Mexican people. So that said, most of the changes are bringing, it's not very clear what it wants to do with private investment already in the electricity sector, but it's very clear what it expects to do in terms of what of CFE can do and what it's allowed to do under the Constitution. Bear in mind that this is not secondary laws or regulations. This is a change directly to the constitutional text, which is very important because I believe sort of the constitutional text should be aspirational in terms of what the law is and what it achieves for its people. And not particularly keen on sort of having percentages on it and who should generate what percentage and what technology should be used and so forth. So that is sort of intriguing of how this or different to the rest of the initiatives. And this one is very clear on having CFE generate 54% of what the whole industry generates. It's a weird number. It comes out of a calculation that was made, or not a calculation. It was the amount of energy produced by CFE in 2018. So that said, it's arbitrary. It doesn't mean that it couldn't be 59 or 42 or any other number. It's just what it was in 2018. One of the objectives is going back to vertically integrated state-owned energy or electricity monopoly. But the second one is a little bit more dangerous in terms of it strikes down the independence of regulators. And this needs a little bit of explanation. The independence of regulators is crucial, and it's crucial to be independent from public policy and from industry participants. Why? They need to be separated from the very short-term needs and goals of any political reality in any country. So that's why mostly in most countries, energy regulators and regulators as a whole are independent from public policy. And this particular initiative tries to go back to a model where there are no independent regulators and that authority will live again within CFE and within the executive branch. So why is this important? Well, mostly because if the regulator depends on what the state monopoly wants, you as a consumer will not have anyone looking out for your long-term interests. I mean, we wouldn't have a level playing field because the authority that is supposed to be looking out for that level playing field would always favor CFE because it depends on CFE or is CFE itself. So it will be absolutely unfair, and it will diminish any kind of interest to continue to invest in Mexico or to operate in Mexico.
Are there other key aspects aside from those two that you would name?
Well, because of the number one aspect, we would have a much more fossil-based energy mix with the obvious impacts on emissions and other pollutants in the areas that are in the radius of those power plants that are owned by CFE.
Right. So CFE power plants, for listeners who are not as familiar with it, they tend to be coal run or diesel run. So one question I have is, we know that COP26 is around the corner, and we're looking at the possibility of an energy sector creating regulations that would allow an energy sector to be dirtier instead of cleaner. Could international environmental agreements serve as some kind of check on AMLO's status goals?
Well, yeah, and I hope so. But most, I think it's important to explain why we are at this point in time. Mm-hmm. Well, CFE is not only generation. CFE is also transmission and distribution, and then it's a supplier of energy to consumers. So it's a horizontally integrated monopoly. So this particular initiative focuses only on CFE as a generator and forgets that currently it has the state, the monopoly on transmission and distribution, which is regulated, and it's the supplier of energy to households and smaller demand clients, and that is also regulated. So it has a lot of other businesses, and it also is a fuel commercial. So this particular one is only focusing on generation. And why is it important? Because most of the new investments and new additions to capacity in Mexico have been made through private investments. And so CFE's power plants tend to be old and with technologies that are not renewable. So that said, if we are to benefit CFE's power plants and generation, we are going to end up with a system that has almost or even more than 75% of fossil fuel generation. And it's also bad for public finances because those thermal power plants are way less efficient and they're more expensive. And so we will end up not being able to comply with our own goals and metrics, both at the Paris Agreement, but also in our energy transition law. So I do hope, and it has many aspects to it, but some of the conversations at the COP are going to be around, well, what are you doing to meet at least with what you already have signed up for in terms of the Paris Agreement. But what are you bringing to the table now that we are here at the COP? So most of the answers will be probably not much, because we are not doing anything above and beyond what we already committed to in terms of the Paris Agreement, but we're going back on our Paris Agreement goals. My opinion is, I don't think if this law passes, we are going to be able to go back on it as easily. Why? Because once you change your constitution, it's very difficult to change it again and keep sort of confidence in terms of the rule of law and that you're a country that respects the law and long-term commitments. So it has a very dark potential for Mexico if this initiative is to pass.
Now, that is a question, if it could pass, because AMLO's coalition lost its two-thirds control of the lower house of Congress in the midterms this summer. So what are the chances that this reform will pass?
Well, it depends on who you ask in terms of the probability of some of the representatives in the chamber to change the votes. If you just look at it in terms of who won and the seats rearrangement, it doesn't have a chance to pass. However, this government has been particularly skillful to go against political adversaries and try to convince them to change their positions. And that is the highest risk. I think if the political class were to be pristine, we wouldn't be having this conversation because they don't have the votes to pass it. But since politics is nothing but pristine, it's not pristine at all. there might be some congressmen that would be willing or forced to change their vote. So I hope it doesn't pass. I don't think it will pass, but the threat is too big for us to just dismiss it.
For our listeners, to be clear, there has been a lot of speculation in the press that AMLO is seeking to divide the Institutional Revolutionary Party, the PRI, which actually was the party that was behind the 2013 energy reform. So it's been something that in Mexican media has been a big debate about whether or not he's going to divide this party, whether or not he's going to be able to then get the votes. One question beyond whether or not he can even get the votes is, do you think that given how far reaching this reform is, knowing that there's a good chance it could be batted back and they reject it, do you think he's just seeing how far he can get? In other words, if he doesn't get the reform to pass, is he trying to give a glimpse of what he's going for? And if so, if it doesn't pass, what do you expect his next steps would be? Are there other ways that he can get to his goal?
Well, he's been trying to do this, to go after these objectives since the very beginning. And we've had lots of regulations and then law changes that have been sort of offset by the judiciary, right? And he would probably go back to that and trying to make noise about it. First of all, I do believe he genuinely thinks that this is good for the country. However, he has this vision of 1970s oil boom Mexico, which is not Mexico right now at all. And also, I mean, there is a lot to say on how that oil boom for Mexico wasn't really positive, but it actually brought a lot of problems to the country's development, economic development. But anyways, I don't think he would just back away from it, at least politically and in the messaging of it. There is one thing that I see in the public debate right now, which is very worrisome, and is the use of false data and false arguments that are easily digestible by people who are not obviously technically robust enough to understand that they're lying to them. And I believe that that is very dangerous to civilization itself. When truth is no longer important and arguments are not technically built and it doesn't matter, it's very, very, very dangerous to how societies can coexist and sort of for civilization itself, to me. So what I've been seeing is that just going out in the media and to the public, pushing for his initiative, allows him or the people behind these ideas to say whatever they want. And I think that gives them a lot of political capital that it might come back to haunt them in the future. But for now, it's a blockbuster of sound bites that people just keep on repeating, although they're absolutely false. And of course, when you go back and try to argue about a number or an idea or how the regulation really doesn't say what they say it says, it's boring because technicalities are boring and people don't like boring anymore. But boring is still reality. To me, it's really complicated to come around to the fact that facts are no longer important. And so, going back to your question of what he will do, I think he will just continue to say whatever is best for his political messaging, which he is a genius at. That is absolutely uncontroversial. He is a complete genius about political messaging, and people just go for it. And it's I don't think he will walk away from that, regardless of the initiative and if it passes or not. Probably it won't, but we'll still be debating false accusations on either the energy companies or CFE itself and what our future is and that sort of thing. And it will just keep on going until another government comes in and decides what to do with their political messaging. But mostly this is no longer a technical conversation. It's a political one. And it's very saddening.
You've made some references to how it might have an impact on investment. We know that the 2013 reform, for example, opened up Mexico's energy sector to not just private investment, but foreign investment. And one other aspect of this is the USMCA. To what degree would this reform run afoul of the USMCA trade deal? And can that pact work as a check on the government's energy goals?
The basic concept here is level playing field. And USMCA makes sure that there's a level playing field in every single sector that it considers. So it would just clearly be against it. And we would start to have a lot of legal battles around it. But mostly what would happen in the very first consequences would be, say, Walmart has globally some goals to use a certain amount of all its energy needs covered by renewables, right? And because Mexico wouldn't be able to assure them that they would have that percentage or that amount of renewable energy, they wouldn't be able to continue their operations or grow their operations here. The same happened to the Tesla plant that was supposed to be built in Mexico, but it wasn't, mostly because there was no assurance on those cars would be built with renewable energy, because there's not enough renewable energy in Mexico. You cannot have that assurance. And so Tesla decided not to build its plant here in Mexico. Say GM. GM has an expansion on electric vehicles, and it would be quite natural for them to expand some of their plants in Mexico. But if there is no possibility to build that electric vehicle with renewable energy, it doesn't make any sense for them to have an electric vehicle with a huge carbon footprint that would just go against their metrics and their goals and their commitments. So those companies, it's just impossible for them to comply with their goals if they continue to operate in Mexico with those frameworks in the electric sector. So it would just have a lot of impacts that are not only because of contract defaults or contract changes or permit cancellations and that sort of thing. It will impact the whole economy.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So there's partially the USMCA and partially also the aspect of what companies have to look at as they're investing. Energy policy in Mexico in general is such a huge, massive issue. So one, we could keep talking for hours, of course. But I want to thank you so much, Montserrat, for talking with me.
My pleasure, completely.
Thank you for joining us. I'm your host, Karin Zessis. This podcast was produced by Luisa Lemmy. The music in this podcast was recorded at America Society in New York City. For more about upcoming concerts, visit musicoftheamericas.org. We hope you enjoyed this episode. You can help us spread the word by giving us 5 stars, writing a review, sharing, and subscribing at Apple, Google, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.